What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series. Hi, I'm JR.
And I'm Rob.
And, well, if you haven't listened to last week's episode of You and Who Talking yet, then go back and listen to last week's episode now, because this is essentially the second half of a two-parter.
Yeah, do yourself a favour, go back and listen to last week's. It was really good in its own right, and it does form, a really nice basis for where we go this week.
It's a two-parter in the same way as Heaven Sent and Hellbent are a two-parter, if you know what I mean. They both work perfectly well without the other, but they both make more sense if you watch them in sequence. Last week, Terry talked about one particular person who was part of his sort of emotional maturity with Doctor Who. And this week, he'll talk about somebody else who's part of that sort of emotional maturing with Doctor Who. But I don't think we should say who and in what circumstance, because what was really nice about this when I first listened to it, when it came in, because Terry hadn't written for the You and Who book, so this was completely an exclusive. What was really nice about this was sort of going on the journey with him.
Yeah, it is actually. I mean, I jotted some notes down here, but I think I'm just going to throw them away, because in our local club we had ... I won't go into it. I'll just, let's just leave him to tell the story perhaps.
Yeah, because sometimes it's nice where you're not sure where something's going to go. And, you know, the author, let's let Terry himself take us by the hand and take us on his journey.
Absolutely. And thank you, Terry, for these three essays that haven't appeared in any of the books so far. Just wonderful. If any of you out there want to do the same as Terry, please write in. Let us know.
Yeah, because as Terry has proven, we've all got a story in us, and, you know, sometimes even the ones that weren't written for the book, sometimes the ones where people just sit down and, you know, spend a couple of hours writing and then spend another half an hour or whatever recording, they can be just as good, if not better, than some of the essays from the books. This is really fantastic, and, you know, I was really chuffed when these came through and I sat down and listened to them.
Yeah, I mean, you might think, oh, this is just my life, no one's interested in that. But if you think of how entertained you are by some of these essays, people would be entertained by what you have to say.
Exactly right, because we all share certain things, and we all have certain things that we don't share, but that we can understand or recognise.
Mm.
And I think even if you think your story's not particularly interesting, it doesn't have to be interesting, because it's not the story, but the person who captures people's interest. Exactly. And I tell you what, we've had some people who've written in and said, look, I don't mind if my story gets read out, but I don't have the voice for reading. That's not necessarily true. We've also had essays from people who think they couldn't do it, who've actually sat down and given it a try, and what they've come up with might not sound like Michael Aspel or somebody like that, you know, off the TV, Frank Boff or whoever, a professional, whatever. But it's not about how professional you sound. It's about how much of yourself comes out in the reading. And, you know, that's the thing that people really latch on to.
They sure do.
Anyway, in the meantime, here's Terry proving what you can do.
Girls and Boys and Doctor Who by Terry Hayward, aged 43, from Bourne in Lincolnshire in the UK. Doctor Who was for boys. I knew that to be an unquestionable truth. If the first 15 years of my life had only taught me one thing, that was it. In the playground when I was 9 years old, it was only me, my friend Sean, and his little brother Ben who reenacted scenes from the latest episode. So much so that Ben often ended up in the unfortunate role of the female companion. I say unfortunate, as he was the one who got to play Perry the day after the first episode of The Twin Dilemma. Sean and I took it in turns to be the Doctor, decry him as an evil fairy, and then attempt to throttle the life out of him. As is the way for little brothers, when he wanted to turn the tables and play the Doctor himself, we refused to indulge him, and a violent row broke out between siblings. A teacher appeared from nowhere to separate them as I sidled away back to my invisible TARDIS. Girls never showed interest in our Doctor Who-based games, and to be fair, we never asked them. As I grew from a small boy into a typical teenager, any interest in a rather creaky sci-fi show that was, according to some people, for kids, was not exactly in the realms of cool. The girls at the time liked Bross and Wet Wet Wet. I liked Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred. Aged 14 and a half at Joanne Gill's birthday party, Leanne Southbury goaded me into standing on a flimsy plastic chair to loudly declare that I hated Doctor Who. I didn't mean it, of course, but everyone cheered. And buoyed on by this and two cans of Scrumpy Jack that James Crouch had smuggled in, I made a daring leap for the dance floor, with the inevitable, undignified result. I shall forever be grateful that, in 1988, no one had yet invented YouTube. However, it was at the very same community centre, not 12 months later, that my beliefs were challenged. I joined the local amateur dramatic group, as I had a penchant for the stage at the time. Having forced my Comte de Rochefort from the Three Musketeers onto an unsuspecting public, it was now pantomime season, and I was cast as Sinistro the Sorcerer, the evil villain of this particular production of Sinbad the Sailor. Also in the cast, and new to the group, was a girl from my school. She was called Tracy, and was in the year below me. We didn't know each other, but we had a mutual friend, and so one conversation led to another, and we began to sit together during rehearsals. She seemed to respond well to my rambling sense of humour, so I realised that she was a young lady of great perspicacity, as John Pertwee might say. Then, one Tuesday evening, whilst others were giving their all on the stage, our conversation turned to what we were watching on TV. It was October 1989, and she was enjoying the latest series of Blackadder, as was I. "I think that's my favourite programme," she said. "Well, that and Doctor Who." If my memory serves me correctly, I think I may have fallen silent for a short while and just stared at her, mouth slightly agape in abject incomprehension. Firstly, here was someone who liked Doctor Who and wasn't afraid to, well, just tell someone, without any warning, apology or caveats. Secondly, and most shockingly, she was a girl. A living, breathing girl who, whilst already attractive, had just flourished into the most amazing and beautiful woman I had ever seen. Please bear in mind I was 15, but even so, this was meant to be, surely. I let the true extent of my fandom out in small chunks, but instead of becoming horrified, she became more interested. I only had a small handful of old Doctor Who episodes on video, and she seemed keen to see them. But what really excited her was when I explained about the Target books. Tracy was a voracious reader, and so I started lending her books, which she ploughed through rapidly. Our conversations became indecipherable to the untrained ear as we discussed everything Who-related far and wide, from Totter's Lane to Gabriel Chase. I knew there was no way I could let this girl slip by. The stars were aligning so perfectly. So, just before Christmas, at the Amdrams party, with my heart beating so loud I truly believed that it could be heard over the music of Rick Astley, I decided to ask Tracy out. She beamed at me and said yes. Yes? Yes! I couldn't believe it! I had a girlfriend, an actual girlfriend, who liked Doctor Who! At this particular point in my young life, this was the most amazing thing that had ever happened to me. Elsewhere, and somewhat inconveniently, The BBC quietly shelved Doctor Who at around this time, so no new episodes were forthcoming. But Target Books were still hanging on in there, and there was a second-hand bookshop in the town where we lived that kept a steady supply of old copies that I didn't have, and BBC Video suddenly ramped up their releases, so our love with Doctor Who, and with each other, grew. Yes, we were young and innocent. Yes, both of us, if we stopped to think about it, were both a little nerdy, perhaps. But who cared? Did I mention I had a girlfriend? Our mutual interest in the tales of an eccentric time traveller in a blue box was the glue that held us together. We would both go searching for Target books I didn't have. We'd rush back to my parents' house to watch each new VHS released upon the market, and we would talk and laugh and run and hold hands, just like the Doctor and Romana in City of Death. Then, imagine our excitement when a new friend from college dropped it into conversation one rainy Monday morning that he knew a nearby sci-fi shop that sold all non-missing Doctor Who videos. I doubted this at first, but my interest had been instantly piqued. I arrived at Tracy's that evening, soaking wet and brandishing a videotape. Still thinking I might have been hoaxed, we huddled around the TV in her parents' back room and pressed play on the video recorder. Through a haze of static came some wobbly pictures, and then the logo of ABC Television in Australia appeared. Before that familiar tune echoed around the room. There we were, in 1990, watching The Green Death, Tracy's favourite Target novelisation, and her marvellous boyfriend had sought out a video copy like a true hunter-gatherer. These were heady days. By the summer of 1991, we had been going out for 18 months. I was 17 and Tracy was 16, and we needed to discuss something serious. Our relationship had matured, and we weren't kids anymore. We discussed things at length, and whilst not wanting to rush into things, we both knew we wanted to take our relationship to the next level. That next level was to go to a Doctor Who convention. We focused our attention on the biggest convention that we were aware of, Panopticon, the annual Doctor Who Appreciation Society convention at the Leofric Hotel in Coventry. There was one tiny problem, though. We lived a very long way from Coventry, and if we were to go, we would have to stay over. My parents seemed unconcerned, but hers were, perhaps understandably, wary of letting their 16-year-old daughter travel halfway up the country to stay in a B&B in Coventry with her weird Doctor Who-loving boyfriend. After all, I might be a bit geeky, but I was still a boy. We concocted a story of how we were going with another friend, let's call him John, who I was going to be sharing a room with. Tracy could then have a room of her own. After some negotiation, the message came back. We could go. So, in autumn 1991, two teenagers caught a train to the West Midlands to their very first convention, and it was everything we could have dreamed of. The stars of Doctor Who were all there in front of us, but so much more there besides. Panopticon was our heaven, and we lapped it up, leaving on the Sunday evening weary but elated. Our relationship had been enhanced by the Doctor. John Pertwee had even signed a poster for Tracy for free, which one of his handlers said never happens. It had been the best time ever. Over the next 12 months, we kept up with our fandom, but drifted away from the amdramatic society that brought us together in the first place. Tracy always got on well with my group of friends, Tony, Richard and Pete, and we started going to the pub together. I'd turned 18 and both of us had started to expand our interests into other things as well as Doctor Who. Music became more prominent in our lives, and whilst I was being drawn into the indie scene, Tracy had shown an interest in a slightly gothy hippie band called All About Eve. I didn't mind them, but they weren't quite my bag. Pete had lent her some tapes which he played almost every day. Still though, we'd lapped up the Doctor Who releases, and we also had some repeats on BBC Two to further our exploration of the show's past. As the previous year's trip to Coventry had passed off without any drama, it was virtually rubber-stamped come 1992. So, again, we made the trip up together and checked in once more to the same B&B as last year, to my mind carrying on the same amazing experience we'd had the year before. On the Friday evening, however, I could sense that Tracy seemed a little distant. She didn't seem as excited as me, as if something was preying on her mind. After a fashion, she told me what was bothering her. Pete and her had been at his listening to All About Eve, and they'd kissed. She was really sorry, and it wouldn't happen again, but, well, she just needed to tell me because she wasn't sure where we were going. In a panic, I burbled like a fool and convinced her this was neither the time nor the place for this conversation. Panopticon was 2 minutes away from us, and that would surely restore any doubts. I wasn't wrong, at least for a while. Somehow, in the following weeks, whenever the conversation veered round to our relationship, I deflected it, and we carried on as we were. It couldn't last, though, and on a grey January day in early 1993, I was sat quietly at home watching episode 3 of Terminus when Tracy unexpectedly arrived. I paused the tape while, with sadness in her eyes, she told me something about it not being me, but that it was her, and how she didn't see where our relationship was going, and, well, she still loved me, but not like that. Not anymore. Her and Pete, well, they seemed to have more in common. I listened to her, but said very little, and then she hugged me and she left. Sat on my own, I pressed play, and continued to watch Peter Davison running round the Lazar ship for about 2 minutes before I turned it off and burst into tears. The 43-year-old me would offer platitudes to his younger self. You've got your whole life ahead of you, plenty more fish in the sea, stuff like that. He would have been absolutely right, of course. This had been a small 3 years of my life, which has faded away as if it's another person's story. I've done so much since, and found that the actual love of my life was someone I'd not yet met. But right there, at that moment, sat on my parents' sofa, my world had ended. I was 18 years old, and I'd now learnt some important life lessons. Firstly, I was probably never going to watch Terminus again. Secondly, I hated Pete with his hippie, gothy, All About Eve nonsense with a burning passion. But fundamentally, I'd learnt that some girls do like Doctor Who.
You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.